Welcome back to the Renegade Economist with your host, Carl Fitzgerald, and we're lucky to have Mr. Rob Adams with us today. He's the Director of Design and Urban Development at the Melbourne City Council. Rob, can you start off by giving some basic understanding of the importance of planning? Often planners come under criticism. Why is it essential to have some forward thinking in the way our towns are built?
Well, I think if you don't have some idea of where you're trying to head, then what you're going to get along the way is ad hoc development. And I suspect that many of our cities suffer from that anyway, because the secret, I think, to a well-designed environment is a clear vision and then an implementation plan as to how you get to that vision. And unfortunately, because quite often, you know, there's a changing of the guard every 3 years, and politically, and sometimes even within the administration, if you didn't have a clear plan, you could see that the cities could change direction every few years. And cities grow very slowly over a long period of time, so you need to have some idea of where you're heading.
And we have seen some controversy in the planning world with the minister, the state minister for planning, Mr. Justin Madden, centralising some planning controls. And in your review, your recent report, Transforming Australian Cities, you talk about the danger of planning keeping up with large-scale development processes. How do you see this recent development?
Well, it's currently, I think, seen by the community as being negative. But if it was managed in conjunction with local government, it could be very positive. I think the stage we've reached with our cities, if I can use an analogy, is where we were in the 1960s with our universities. In the 1960s, you got all the baby boomers coming through to university. You got a huge expansion in the population going to universities. A lot of them were embedded within cities, and they suddenly find they had to extend their facilities. And they just didn't have the money to do that. So it didn't become, the solution wasn't to actually build and extend the university, but rather to look at how you utilize the infrastructure that already existed within those universities. And what they found, for instance, was those lecture theatres were only being used for 15% of the time. We've got that exact analogy in our cities at the moment. We're going to see Melbourne grow to 5 million by 2029. We need to be able to A, articulate a strategy, and B, put it in place very quickly, because we haven't got the luxury of dwelling on it and being overtaken by ad hoc development spilling out into the countryside and extending the financial difficulties that people on the fringe are already facing.
In your recent report, Transforming Australian Cities, you received quite a lot of positive press about the forward-thinking nature of it. And can you explain to us in some detail the basic premises to your move to increase densities, housing densities?
Yes. I think the simplest way of trying to explain where I was going is that we have the cities in their current form, and we're not going to change that very quickly. So we need to work with what we've got. And so if you look at and take Melbourne, because that's mostly as good an example as any. If you look at Metro Melbourne, I postulate that you only possibly have to change 6% of the area of the urban growth boundary, within the urban growth boundary, to get a much more efficient, dense, sustainable city. And that would happen in two or three basic ways. Firstly, wherever you have a railway station, which is known as an activity center, it makes sense to put populations in and around railway centers. When they laid out the railway system in other countries in the UK, that's exactly what happened. In and around the railway centers, stations, you got centers of activity, communities. We need to do that. In 2030, the state government strategy is doing that. We mostly just need to make the rules very explicit, and I would argue you don't need any building higher than 8 stories. You need mixed use. You need medium to high densities in there, and you need to create quality streets, because good urban design results out of having a good public realm, and 80% of the city is the street. The next opportunity exists in our road-based public transport networks that run between those centres. And there we've invested in a very expensive infrastructure called the tram or the bus, and we place that on the street. If we could have a very thin ribbon of dense development flanking those tram lines and bus routes, then you could get 3.3 million people within the current urban growth boundaries of the city without subdividing any more land. That's just working within the existing land that is already occupied. My argument to that is if you did that, you'd be putting people close to public transport, and therefore the public transport could become more efficient and more financially viable. You'd only be taking over 6% of the city, and the other 94% would only have to tree itself up, collect its own energy through solar voltaics and collect its own water to not only become sustainable in itself, but may be able to collect energy and water for the higher density areas which thread their way through. The saving also to society, a recent study showed that if you build 1,000 houses on the fringe, it costs about $300 million more than building 1,000 houses within the fabric of the city, would be about $110 billion over the next 50 years. So there's a huge saving financially. I would argue that as long as when you gave the rights for development along these corridors and in the activity centers, you accompanied a requirement to provide 25% affordable housing, you would get affordable housing, you'd get social improvements, easier access to services, and it would be a more sustainable city as well. So I think it ticks all those three boxes. So the reason, going back to your earlier thing about the minister's powers, to do that, you're going to need a very clear planning mechanism that gives as-of-right development. And that could be a positive use of the minister's powers if local government could come together with a single voice and jointly point to the areas where they think development can take place and the areas of stability, which the other 94% could remain within their sort of authority.
There's a lot of controversy amongst any form of development, and the NIMBY mob, not in my backyard type mob, seems like this proposal could curtail some of their concerns, because it's really just along the development strips that you're talking about.
Well, you've only got a 6% NIMBY factor, haven't you? Because the other 94%, it wouldn't be in their backyard. So, and I think, you know, that's why a clarity within the planning rules is necessary. I mean, I would argue that our planning system has become too complex. And what the planning system should be doing now is doing one of two things. It should be clearly articulating where we want development, development that will benefit the existing infrastructure, because as with the universities in the 1960s, we haven't got time to build new infrastructure for this rapidly increasing population. And those areas are called key development areas, and the rest is really an area of stability. That's the 94%. And in those areas, you already have a character, you know, be they suburban residential areas or whatever. And you would work within those character constraints. So you wouldn't push alien development into those areas. And neither do you have to, because there's a capacity in that 6%.
We're talking to Robert Adams, the Director of Design and Urban Environment at the Melbourne City Council. And Rob, one of the concerns some people have is that our infrastructure is already overcrowded. How will it cope, and how will you finance the expansion of that infrastructure when this added density occurs?
It can happen in a number of ways. The thing I think we've got to start working towards is not having to replace the infrastructure that already exists. So if we take water, for example, and this, I suppose, is coming out of our learnings out of our own building CH2 in Little Collins Street, that it would make sense to strategically place medium-scale sewer mining projects around the metro area on trunk sewers, where you could take the sewerage out, and ideally these would be located near to public parklands, etc. If you could locate those and take the sewerage out, take part of the water out and use it on the adjacent parklands to benefit them, you could build it back into the sewerage system about a 40% capacity without affecting the flow rates within those sewers at the moment. That would enable you to then build increased densities along those sewer lines, which are usually the same corridors I've been talking about, and save you the, you know, very high cost of digging them up and replacing them with larger pipes. The same happens with electricity. Our current system with Latrobe Valley is a bit like pushing water up the Yarra. We generate in one area, we dig it up, we push it through very thin wires which are vulnerable to things like fires and whatever. We then put it on the house, we heat up water again. We end up with about a 3% efficiency if we do it that way. If you put a solar voltaic on your roof, it's about 20% efficient and goes straight into the house. And if it's not into your house, it's into the house next to you, and it trickles down the system until it finds its need. It is a far more efficient way of providing a distributed energy system than building big power stations and trying to push it upstream. So, and if you, you know, don't take my word for it, go to Ergon Energy in Queensland, North Queensland, and that's exactly what they're advocating. And their CEO up there is a very enlightened energy person. So what we've got to do is start looking at our infrastructure with a completely different set of eyes. We're not going to solve the problems we've created by using the same methods that we actually use to create them. We're going to have to look at them with a new set of eyes and say, as the universities did, this is not about building infrastructure. This is about re-timetabling or getting greater utilization out of the assets we already have.
Rob, I like the idea of that sort of closed-loop system where we're actually recycling either waste or additional energy. What about the change in zoning and how that's going to affect land values along those growth corridors? The moment your report came out, as if it wasn't already happening, astute land investors / speculators would be snapping up those properties along the Sydney Roads, the Johnson Street bus cycle routes and the like. How do you propose capturing some of that finance that would be attributed to land values by the zoning change?
It's not dissimilar to what the state government is trying to get through the upper house at the moment, where they're saying if we open up more growth areas, there will be a tax on those growth areas to provide the services that are required to support them. A similar principle would be to say, if we go into the planning authority, identify areas of the city where we will give you as of right development up to a certain level, which would enhance the value of that property, we'll take back a proportion of that to use for public good. So it's a betterment tax. And that public good could be affordable housing, it could be improved open space or extended open space as you get greater densities. It could be used in whatever way governments and communities think is the best use of that money. You've got to do it at the time you change the planning rules, because when you change the planning rules, you, in most cases, increase the value of the land. So if someone's run out today and bought something, they'll be speculating. If you then go back out to that person and say, we've decided this particular plot can accommodate a five-story dwelling, you've got as of right to five stories, but we're taking 25% out because its original use was single or double story, then they can't complain. I mean, if they've paid too much, well, that's speculation. You get it wrong every now and again. So the betterment tax, and it's something, it's not foreign. If you build residential in the central city here, we take a 3% open space levy off you so that we can build more open space. It exists in the planning scheme, and we need to get it back in. So as you increase the values, you take the betterment tax out and you use it to community benefit, be it affordable housing, open space, whatever.